Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneurs Podcast Show. My name is Josh, and I'm here with our founder, David Brim, and we're having a conversation with one of his great friends that they've known each other a while, and we're going to pull him on the show to capture some of his wisdom, his knowledge, his experience, and being an Orlando-based entrepreneur. So everyone, I want you to welcome Mr. Mike Wright of MMI Development to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So ladies and gentlemen, listening in, you might be driving, walking, running, or working. Whatever you're doing, you're going to hear a few different voices. My name is Josh, and I'm the host, so I'll be talking a lot, and you'll hear David pop in and then Mike. So you're going to hear three different voices, but I just want to set the stage of kind of like a roundtable discussion with this guy named Mike. All right. So Mike, why don't you tell us and in the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay, my name is Mike Wright. I am president of MMI Development, and we've been doing business for roughly 19 years, and I transitioned into that role for a variety of reasons from a previous role, which was a senior partner at a law firm here in town. I don't know if you want to know the name of the law firm or not, but it's Gray Robinson. It used to be Gray Harrison Robinson. And, you know, I just left one day and said, I don't want to do this anymore.
You just woke up one day and said, I don't want to do this anymore?
Yeah, I mean, there's a story for that. I mean, there's reasons why people do what they do, and there's reasons why people don't do what they do. And so the reasons why I walked out of my law career, I have a very specific set of reasons why I did that. So it was interesting how it all worked out. But
when you left Gray Robinson, did you transition into your own law practice, or did you jump into the real estate world?
I wrote the bar a letter and said I don't want to be a licensed lawyer anymore, and I took probably $20,000 or $30,000 worth of clothes down to Goodwill and says I'm done. That was that. So.
Did you know what you were jumping into? Because entrepreneurs a lot of times are in a position of transition where something happens and they transition into their new career.
Well, that happened. There were a couple of things that kind of intersected. So one thing is I had an acquaintance in Memphis, Tennessee that was in the hotel business, and they were very successful hotel operators. And I, before moving to Florida and taking a job in law firms here, I was in-house counsel with a national life insurance company, and I was head of their real estate portfolio. I was legal counsel to the real estate department, who managed a multi-billion dollar real estate portfolio. And that's how I really got started in real estate, honestly, because when I got out of law school, originally I had no job. So I just went home and hung out a shingle in rural Mississippi and practiced law for a year. That's a whole nother podcast for a year of practicing rural Mississippi when you don't have a job. But that's how I got into the real estate, and that's how long I've been working in real estate is with the life company, because they had a very large real estate portfolio, commercial real estate. And then I went transitioned into a law firm and continued practicing until I decided I didn't want to do anymore. So the factors that kind of led me into chucking it, we'll call it the chucking day and this leaving day or whatever, is so my family, and we've been from Mississippi, had been there for like 8 generations way back. In fact, this is this table predates the Civil War. It has been in my family probably for 150 years.
Oh, wow.
And you can see the square nails in it. It was all handmade. So they had a very large tract of land, several thousand acres. And when my grandfather passed away, he split it up between my mom and my uncle, and we decided to take our share. At the time, people were really wanting to buy timberland, farmland, stuff like that. So we sold it all, and my share was about $75,000. So that's where I started my company, was on $75,000 basically.
So what did you do with that $75,000? And can walk us through the journey of how you started and kind of where you're at today.
Yeah, there's an ancillary to. Okay, so we inherited this land. I decided to sell it. Felt very bad about it. It was very bad. I still feel bad to this day about selling it because that land was purchased in the 1850s. So for me to come along 150 years later and sell it, I felt kind of betraying my family to some degree, but oh well. I'm glad that I took it and did something with it. But the other thing really that kind of bothered me and what projected me out of, I mean, you don't just quit practicing law for $75,000. That's not what you do. There was probably bigger forces in play. Is I actually never really intended to ever be a lawyer. I was talked into it by my uncle. And the other thing that I didn't want to do is, you know, by the time I was 45, I was in the top floor of the corner office, had a senior partner, giant law firm, making good money. That's everything you want to do, right? So I'm 45 years old, and I'm seeing people in our firm and other firms that were in their 80s doing the same thing that I was doing when I was 45. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this for another 35 or 40 years. It ain't going to happen. I'm not going to do it. I'm just not that kind of person. And I never intended to be a lawyer to begin with. You know, when I grew up, particularly my family, and I think a lot of families, and this is not typical of Mississippi or the South, I think it's typical of a lot of places, is most sons and daughters kind of did what their parents wanted them to do. So what my parents wanted me to do was get educated and be successful and, you know, blah, 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 whatever that meant. So, you know, when my uncle says, well, you should go to law school, that's what I did. You know, he was senior geologist worldwide for ExxonMobil. He's a really high up guy. So he had homes in, you know, Venezuela, which is one of his favorite countries. He had a home in the Manila in the Philippines, and he had a home in Houston. So we were out there, and I'd already applied, I think, to go to Emory and get my MBA and all that. And he asked me what I was going to do, and I said, well, I'm going to go to Emory or, you know, Emory or Duke or somewhere and get my MBA. And because I got my undergraduates in economics and finance, I just thought an MBA was more of a natural follow-on to those degrees. And he said, well, you know, at my level, there are only two kinds of degreed individuals that are at my level. He said, if a geologist, because we know where the oil and gas are, and the lawyers that help us regulate, manage it, and stay out of trouble and maximize our profits. He said, there's no MBAs at our level. So I don't mean to pour water, cold water on MBAs, but that's kind of what he told me. So I said, you know, maybe that's a good idea. I'll go to law school. So I applied to Ole Miss, got accepted. That's a whole nother podcast, too, making through Ole Miss Law Center at the time, because we had a diploma privilege and didn't have to take the bar when you got out. So our passage rate at the time was probably in the 20 to 30% range.
Wow.
So about 60 to 70% of the people who attended with me originally were gone within first year, maybe halfway into the second year.
So when you were at this role at the law firm, and like you said, you were making great money, it's what a lot of people dream for. It's the dream career of, you know, pulling in that kind of income in a corner office. Was it challenging for you to make that leap? You said there were a couple factors, but what was going through your mind at that time when you made that jump to say, I'm going to go into business on my own?
Well, I inherited the money, so that was one thing. And it wasn't all mine, but my share was a certain amount. And then there was the people who I didn't want to be like them. So, and I was really kind of tired of practicing law. I've been doing it for 20-something years. But the thing that tipped me over into it, and if I understand your question, what is the biggest challenge for transitioning?
Yeah, taking the leap and leaving a financially stable job, not knowing where your income is going to come from right away.
Yeah, I think with any entrepreneur that you have to just have confidence in yourself. You can't ever give up, ever, no matter what. And you know, there's going to be barriers to every single thing you want to do. And there's a giant barrier to success, and that's discipline and patience and intellect and education. And so you got to, I think the biggest impediment to being a successful entrepreneur is just having the spine to ride it out and have confidence in yourself. But, you know, and I had a lot of confidence, you know, in myself. And I just, I don't know what I can say on this podcast.
You can say whatever the heck you want.
Yeah. So the number one thing that I said to myself, I remember walking down to the president of the firm to tell him I'm leaving the firm. And I said this over and over and over, and I still say it to this day, and I preach it to people who work with me, like Tommy. Mm-hmm. And don't ever believe your own bullshit, because you will feed yourself so much bullshit into your brain about how great you are, and how great this project is, and how much money it's going to make. It's all bullshit. Okay, because if you keep that mindset, then you'll make good decisions. And you need to be patient. Don't take the first opportunity, so to speak, and think that's going to be the opportunity that sets the course for everything else to come, because it's just not that way. So things come along, and they come along in a way that you don't even know sometimes what your biggest and best opportunities are. You just don't know. And I don't care how smart you are or how experienced you are, things are going to come along that you didn't anticipate, and but you got to stay off that bullshit train.
Yeah, nobody wants to jump on that train. It sounds very messy.
So when I went down to, when I went down to quit and turn in my resignation letter, president of the firm said, "Well, that's a big mistake, Mike. You shouldn't do this." And he said, "You know, those last seven lawyers that left here to go start their own businesses, they all went bankrupt. They all failed." And I said, "Well, I had a year of statistics, and that gives me an 87.5% chance of success."
Yeah.
So
that's a good way to think about it.
That's right? The kind of way I look at it, you know, is, okay, you know, you got to have confidence and just believe in what you're doing and educate yourself. Never ever get up on a given day and say, "Well, you know, I don't think I need to learn anything today," because I get up and learn something every single day, every day, whether it's watching YouTube, listening to podcasts, you know, talking on the phone with somebody that has a different experience. Yeah. You know,
so Mike, let's get tactical, right?
Okay.
So you were corner office, top floor, balling out, right? Like you're doing great. Though, like, your uncle would have been proud, right? He said, "You need to go this route to be high up." And you said, "No, I'm going the route of starting my own business. I just had a little bit of money windfall in my direction from an inheritance, but it's time. I didn't want to be like these 80-year-old guys, you know, that are doing the same thing that I'm doing at 45.
Nothing against the 80-year-old guys.
Yeah, nothing against that.
Because I'll be there soon.
You just wanted something different. So you said, "I'm going to do this." What was that you said, "I'm going to jump to"?
Okay, so the first deal I worked on, and maybe that's a example of what to do. So these people out of Memphis that I was telling you about, I was representing them on finding deals. They say, "Hey, find us some deals down there." Well, I'm okay.
Nice.
So I went out and found them a deal. We bought an old burnout hotel. I think we paid about $1.8 million for it. And we put another $2 million into the property. So we had about $4 million in it. And then we refinanced. But the deal did so well that the mortgage we qualified using typical underwriting standards, you know, debt service coverage ratio, loan to value, all those kind of factors, we were able to put like an $8 million loan on the property because it was a cash cow.
Wow.
And so we did that deal, and we did two more deals around that deal, and we did a couple more deals. We did one in downtown D.C.
So with the $8 million loan, you sucked out the equity of that property and
100%
used it to invest in other deals?
Well, not me, but I was just the lawyer on that. I wasn't a partner in that one. I was just their lawyer. So I did the partnership agreement, the private placement memorandum, all the real estate transactional information, you know, documents and stuff like that. So,
but you had an inner knowledge and understanding of how that process worked because you were with them throughout the whole journey.
I think, yeah, I guess so. I mean, honestly, I found that deal for them, and I think it was kind of like a blind hog finding an acorn. because I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I did.
That's a Mississippi analogy for those listening.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have a thing that says, you know, when somebody gets lucky and does real well, we'll say even a blind hog finds an acorn. You know, if you sniff around enough, you're going to find one.
Yeah.
So, and you're going to feed yourself. So, so they asked me, hey, and I'm actually getting your answer your question. So they said, would you find more deals for us? And I said, I'll do that. So, you know, I get out and ride around, look at deals and ask people, talk to people. It's all about networking too. Very important. Network every single day. Don't ever stop networking. Doesn't mean you have to do business with everybody, but you're getting information, you're learning different perspectives, you're learning about potential opportunities. You're also, you know, maybe finding somebody who might be a good partner, because you can't do it all. You know, I used to do it all, but I like having partners. I don't like doing stuff by myself. I've done a lot of deals by myself, but I've also had a lot of partners, and I think good partnerships are really good things to have. So I found another piece of property. I got it under contract using my $75,000 share of my inheritance, and put it under contract, and basically taught myself how to develop property. And that took about, that deal to me was a primer on how to develop multifamily. It took me 3 years to get through figuring it out. So, but I had the right kind of contract. So, and I had the right kind of price. So I got the price under contract, was worth, I got it under contract for like 400 grand. And it was also small enough to where I could close on it with my own money if I needed to. And so I told the guys in Memphis, hey, I got this site under contract, it's $400,000. I got a contract that says all we have to do is get our permits and entitlements and then we close. And they're like, well, we don't know anything about multifamily. I said, well, it's a lot less riskier than hotels, which it is. And they said, well, we're out. So left me holding the bag on the deal. And so I closed on it by myself. I borrowed money from the bank, put my $75,000 down, and just worked through the zoning. Had to go back through rezoning again because of some mistakes that were made by the architect. And I had an engineer that really made that deal what it turned out to be. And so once I got my rezoning and all my entitlements for 240 unit apartment project, so 240 units at the time, that land for apartments was selling for about $8,000 a unit. So that's about $1.7 million was the value on the land. And my cost basis was about $400,000.
Wow.
So we wanted to build the apartments, and a guy flew into town one day, and we had a meeting right here in this house. He flew into town, looked at the site, and said, I'll sign the note. And he had a couple hundred million in net worth, and that was it. We were off to the races. So we went and pulled our permits and started to build. And I didn't really want to wait for the property to be completed and stabilized, because that's a 2 or 3 year process to build the apartments, and then you got to stabilize them. And I told them I really wanted to be bought out. So they bought me out, actually.
Was it the note holder ended up buying you out?
The guy who signed the note, the big guy, he's, because in every deal you have capital. So capital is broken into two different types. There's debt and equity. So he was the equity provider, but he also provided the debt by signing the note.
Because
that's expensive. I mean, to build 240 units today, you're talking about $45-50 million project. At the time, that was about a $15-20 million project. So to sign that kind of note takes some serious net worth and liquidity. So he signed the note, never met me before. He was a risk taker and real nice guy, super nice guy. I don't know if I can say his name or not.
Sure, give me a shout out.
Jim Rudnick out of Tallahassee, one of the best people I've ever met. So he was introduced to me by a guy named Robbie Browning, who also networked with. So Robbie I just met because Robbie was in the apartment business, had done a lot of projects, did very well. And he introduced me to Jim Rudnick, and you know, we're friends to this day.
Yeah. So, have you guys done more deals?
We've looked at more deals, but we haven't really. I mean, actually, we did do more deals after that, actually, but we're not doing anything currently. So
now we're as we're walking through this journey, I'm seeing a lot of gold as we're walking by. I'm seeing a lot of gold, golden nuggets of wisdom and experience that I know my audience is going, okay, let's talk about this. Okay. You said every day you learn something new, mm-hmm. and every day you network. Let's look at the side of networking.
Okay.
All right. Because you one of your first things that you went to do is to find deals. So what are some tactical ways that my entrepreneurs and the audience could go out and hit their network up to find deals and opportunities? So okay. That's the first question.
Okay. So the how do I find deals? So this first deal was somebody brokered it to me, because that's your biggest database of actionable properties. I mean, there's a lot of property around, but it's not actionable if it's not for sale or whatever, you know. Maybe the best location in the world, but if it's not for sale, it doesn't matter. So I'd say the brokerage community is a huge resource for transactions. So that first deal, the second deal I did was very similar to that. And it's just one that my wife and I, we got in a car one day and said, hey, let's ride around and see if we can find a deal. And we did. We found another deal. We made $1 million on it.
Nice.
So we just decided Sunday, we don't have anything to do. We had a new baby. Let's put the baby in the car because she likes to sleep when we drive. Mm-hmm. We can sit at home and listen to her cry, or we can put her in the car and ride around and look for deals.
And that's called driving for dollars.
Driving for dollars.
Around, looking around for that.
So, in fact, we lived here, and it's my daughter y'all met earlier. Okay. So she was what led to the second deal we did. And so I think driving around, like I drove around yesterday looking at deals. I found a couple that I like around Orlando, and I found another one today.
Very cool. Now, how could you drive by? So in Orlando, how many people do we have in Orlando? A lot.
The whole area is 2.5 million.
2.5 million people are driving by these properties, right? Mm-hmm. How come you can see the gold in an opportunity where everybody else is driving by? Like, what should us entrepreneurs learn to do when we're seeing things? How do we look for opportunities? How do we change our mindset to see that? Right?
So I'll give you a couple of examples. So one of the deals I'm looking at is a chain of big boxes. They went out of business, and they now have their locations for sale. So with those locations, if you see an empty box that went out of business, there's an opportunity there, because there's somebody owns that real estate, something went bad, and they're trying to, you know, rectify the value that was there. So those things come into play. If you see vacant land, any vacant land can be developed. If it's vacant, it's not being monetized. You know, there may be somebody that owns it that wants to monetize that dirt, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another saying also is, where's the best place to put a McDonald's? Right next to a Burger King. So if you see success and you see it in a location, then you want to try to duplicate that success. So if you see apartments do really well at a location, is there another piece of land around there that you can develop?
Now, I think that's awesome, this idea of duplicate success. Modeling, duplicate success, R&D, rip off and duplicate, right? So there's a bunch of ideas around this. A lot of people will see a McDonald's or a Burger King on the corner and they'll go, oh, I guess someone got to it first.
Yes.
Whereas you're saying, no, that's the best place to put it is right next to
another one.
How did you develop that mindset? Or when was the first time that you saw that example?
I think it's common sense.
To you, yes.
Well, so many people run away from competition, but I think in that case, it's like a rising tide floats all boats approach, right?
That's correct, yeah. And we're big on cycle. Where are we in the cycle? You know, that's an incredibly important thing we look at on everything we do. For example, we're very deep into the multifamily cycle. In my opinion, we're probably 7 years into it, and there's never been a 7-year multifamily cycle. So for me to start a new project right now, even though everything looks so rosy, it causes me a little concern right now to do anything, even though things are great. That's when you start thinking about your economics learning. You know, there's cycles. There's always been cycles. I mean, you go back and read Roman history. History of the Roman Empire is over 1,000 years. Those 1,000 years had economic cycles. They had bankruptcies. They had collapses. They had all of these things that are happening today happened 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. If you read history, you'll educate yourself on these cycles. Then when you get into the cycles and the bigger picture of cycles, meaning recession, recovery, expansion, deflation, recession, mm-hmm. those are your cycle. So and asset classes also have cycles, meaning apartments, office, retail, industrial, flex space, those are all asset classes, and they all interact differently with that big cycle. So apartments generally lead every, so I've been through five recessions, and apartments have led every one of those recoveries, every one of them. Because nobody's building industrial, nobody's building flex space, nobody's building hotels, nobody's building office. All of those asset classes are asset classes that depend on a steady, defined, expansionary cycle economically. Whereas apartments, it's kind of spec by nature. You know, you don't go out and sign up 300 leases and then build your apartment project. You kind of, it's like that movie about the guy building the baseball field.
With Field of Dreams.
Yeah, if you build it, they will come,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so that's the risky part of apartments. But, you know, when I was at the life insurance company, though, we had a book in the library. It was called 100 Years of Investing by the Life Insurance Industry. And the very first page, it said, no asset class has produced a higher rate of return over a longer period of time with the least amount of measured risk over 100 years than multifamily rental. That's number one, or at least it was when that book was published, which would have been back in the 70s or the 80s. I started my law career in 82, I believe, yeah. So, you know, I've been a big believer in apartments because of that. So the other thing is office. We've done 11 or 12 office projects. Most of those have been in Miami. And we only do very specific kind of office projects. We don't build spec. We don't build to suit. We only buy and reposition existing. So if you're not building value through something, then you're just static. Let's say you go out and build... Let's say you go out and bought an office building, you know, SunTrust Center, let's say it's 95% leased and the economy's good. You're going to make 7 or 8% return on your money and that's it, which maybe is not bad, but it's not enough for the risk you're taking. Because if you're buying a building and it's 95% leased, you have nowhere to go.
What's your upside of it? Yeah.
You have no upside. You have nothing to compensate yourself for that risk you're taking. Because you're taking, to me, anytime you buy a stabilized project that's not multifamily, you're taking on a lot of risk because it has nowhere to go but down.
Huh. So you, when you're looking for opportunities, you mentioned this. When you're driving and you see a vacant building, vacant land, you're seeing something where there's a potential problem where you could value add to it.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, we don't do deals, we don't do projects unless we're adding value. And we have a kind of a minimum underwriting standard, meaning that if we can't get a 20 to 30% annual return on our money, we're probably not going to be interested in it. That's number one. Number two is... we need to be able to double our money. We have, it's called multiple capital measurement. So if we want to do a deal, it's got to meet some parameters. And, you know, we'll do budgets, pro formas, we do cash flow models. We have a very extensive Excel model that we build, and we model the mathematics of the multifamily project. So it's almost like running, it's like you're building it and running it on a spreadsheet. Over a 2-3 year period. So we model it mathematically so that you see how it works. And then we build into those assumptions a lot of very conservative factors so that so we're not believing our own bullshit. So yeah. It still translates into the model. So if you assume your rents are this, well, why don't you ratchet down, kind of stress it? Because you can take that model and stress all these different parameters that make it successful. And you stress them down to make it say, okay, worst case scenario, you know.
So when you get into a deal or you're analyzing a deal, you're saying, okay, here's our upside. Here's, you know, this is where we need to be.
Yeah.
And then you say, what's the worst case scenario when you're looking at a property? So you kind of put those two parameters.
That's correct.
Where do you usually hit within those?
We almost always beat our projections. So, and that's very important to do that. You need to, we've never finished a budget. We've never finished a project on budget. ever. Now, that sounds bad, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But we've never finished it above budget either. We always finish our projects under budget.
It's fantastic.
So we've never had a project where we were in control making the decisions that we finished on or over budget. So that's number one. So what that does is it tells us that we do a good job budgeting.
Yeah.
So the other thing we do is we have a project we're under construction right now in Tampa. We projected that probably to sell for about $205,000 a unit. But a project close to us is under construction, or they just finished, and I think they're going to sell theirs for like $240,000 a unit. So we're going to make probably $30,000 to $40,000 a unit profit more than what we had originally projected. Just because, not that we, you know, it's just that we put the model together, we look at our underwriting standards on return on cost, internal rate of return, IRRs, and the multiple of capital. Once we meet all that, we stress it down. And then once we stress it, that's kind of what we go to the market on, the market being capital. So we need capital. So in that deal, we had to raise $46 million. That was a combination of debt and equity. So, but that project's going to be, it's going to be much more successful than we probably originally anticipated. So, but you know, that's so we're very contrarian. We like to buy low. We like to buy low when people are selling.
Yeah.
That's usually bad times when there's a rush to the door. So, when things are bad, everybody's selling things. They're trying to get liquid, or they're trying to pay off their debt, and they're trying to hunker down for the storm. So that's when they're liquidating things. So everything we've built over this last cycle has been land that we owned from the last meltdown. So we bought enough land in 2008, 2009, when a lot of people were liquidating. We bought enough land to build probably five or six apartment projects, probably 2,500 units of apartments. So
let's play a game. Right.
This is what I answer your questions. I don't even know if I'm answering your question. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think so.
Great information.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm taking a bunch of notes, but when we're talking, there's a few like things that that I'm like, okay, this is super valuable for the audience, and I want to dive deeper into a few things.
Okay.
So let's just say me, you, and David are sitting here right now, and we came across a cool project, and we had to go raise $46 million.
Right.
How would you approach that together with our team right here, me, you, and David? How would we go raise $46 million for a capital project?
I'd make a couple of phone calls and a couple of emails, and we're done.
And boom, $46 million.
That goes back to the networking, right? Meeting the right people, having a
performance. No, I mean, that goes back to, I say, I like good partners. So I have really good partners. I have partners in New York. I have partners in Miami. I've had partners in Latin America, a lot of Latin American partners. In Uruguay, Panama, places like that. And these are gentlemen that have operating companies. They do manufacturing. They make a lot of money manufacturing. And my partners in New York are, I don't know if I want to say who they are.
Yeah, just tell us their names and number after we stop recording.
Well, I will tell you this. They really like baseball a lot. And that's the only reason they own a $1.3 billion baseball team.
Wow,
that's how.
Just because they like baseball,
they like baseball.
That's cool.
That's all I'm going
to
say.
Good place to be.
Yeah.
So they can lend me some money if I need it, and so that deal. Sometimes we actually use brokers. There are brokers in the capital brokerage business. That's what they do. They data mine. They're on the phone. They're on the. So they're doing all that networking for you. They bring in these capital funds or family office. But the guys that put up the common equity, those are existing partners of mine. They're where we've done other deals, and I've done really good returns for them. We've never had a project foreclosed. We've never had a loan called. We've never had a default on a document, ever. We have never given back a piece of property, ever. We have never failed to deliver a return to our partners, and we have a perfect record. And hopefully, you know, we'll continue to have that kind of record until I decide not to do this anymore. But I think it's because we're very conservative, but I think it's probably also because we're very contrarian, meaning you know, buy low, sell high. That's what they say, right?
Yeah.
Buy low, sell high. So you buy low when everybody's selling. So what that means is I may go into a mode here very soon where I'm trying to maximize my liquidity and trying to not do any deals, which is hard to do if you're a deal guy and you're a deal junkie. You're always wanting to do deals, right? And you're being presented with a lot of bullshit. You got to decide to not buy into it. So you know, if you go into a recession with a lot of liquidity and some good partners that have a lot of liquidity, then you can take advantage of a lot of things, because people are usually selling stuff 10, 15, 20, 30 cents on the dollar. Hmm. And we did a lot of that in 08 and 09.
So how many dollars in real estate development have you done as far as total investment? And
probably between 500 and 700 million.
How many doors? Like
apartments?
Yeah.
Probably, I don't know, 1,300, 1,400, 1,500 maybe.
Wow.
So I have a question about asset classes, because you were talking about different types of real estate asset classes. You've done office. You mentioned that you've done some hotel, mm-hmm. lots of multifamily. Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered any other types of asset classes, like taking a small amount of your portfolio and investing it in, let's say, an early stage tech startup portfolio?
Nah.
Could you kind of elaborate on that? Because that this is a topic that's, in Central Florida, it's a topic that a lot of us have talked about, that there is money here, there's access to people with money and lots of partners around the country. But what are the kind of factors that cause you to say, no, I wouldn't really be interested of, even if it's a small percentage, like 1 to 3% of your portfolio in something like that?
I have no interest in doing something I don't know anything about.
Gotcha.
And when I say I don't know anything about it, I really don't. I may know the dirt and the numbers, but there's always those qualitative factors that are hard to see that, you know, that an experienced operator or experienced developer, let's say flex space, you know, or industrial or even movie theaters or whatever. You know, if you've done a bunch of those, you know where all the traps and all the dangers are. If you're new to something, you're not going to know those. You're just not. And I don't want to learn anything more on that side. You know, I don't want to learn that stuff.
It's definitely a different mentality in that there's so many more variables when it's an early stage operating business than a tangible real estate asset. But I think that there's a lot of conversation and momentum trying to, the idea of converting real estate investors into even a small percentage of a portfolio into tech. But I think it is an education standpoint, seeing really good successes that are happening.
I'll give you, also, real estate is, that's not going anywhere. You know, its value may fluctuate, but it's not at the end of the day going anywhere. So a tech business or any operating business, once the system that warranted that operational business to produce a profit, once that system starts to break down, it goes down pretty quickly to zero, and it completely evaporates. So to me, real estate is a lot safer, because at the end of the day, it's a tangible asset, whereas an operating business, which is a tech business, you're talking about, you know, apps or systems or whatever it is, that's an operating business that depends on a system of people, processes, and products. And if any of those parts break down in there, and everybody decides to quit participating in the process that one would think needs to continue to operate for that business to have value, then this goes to zero. I mean, you may have some desks and chairs and computers to liquidate, and that's about it.
So it really goes back to timing as well, of understanding when to get out. And if that's not an asset class that you have experience with, again, it's very foreign, and kind of sticking in your lane is kind of the...
Yeah, so what we're doing is we've developed a Wawa. We were working on some TLEs, which is learning experience. It's the largest pre-K company, and those are retail type deals. And we've done 11 office building projects, and we've done 5 or 6 multifamily projects. And so the office is also a cyclical thing, meaning when do you get in, when do you get out. So we sell almost everything we do because of the cycle. So
what do you think, has there ever been a time in the, you said you've been doing this for 19 years.
So my point back to your question is, once you learn that and you've been through those cycles and you understand those asset classes and that's what you do, there's really not a lot of motivation at that point to go out and take on all new types of businesses, especially an operating business. So,
now, if there was, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but if there was a group of successful investors who understand that asset class and they came to you and said, you know, 1% of your portfolio kind of going into something like that, but you trusted them in their judgment, is that something that you would consider even if you weren't actively managing it? Similar to like a, I mean, if you're investing in anything, stock
market. I think if I, you know, I'm 61, I'll be 61 in about a week or so, but I think right now with me and my personality and what I like to do is I like to be in charge.
Sure.
So
I think the reason that this question is so important is we have a lot of entrepreneurs out there who are looking for capital and capital sources. Mm-hmm. And there's this wide rift between need and availability of capital here in Central Florida.
But there's a lot of ways for those people to get capital just as easily as I do, because there's a lot of people that want to invest in tech.
Yeah.
They want to invest in new operational businesses. So there's a lot of people out there that do that. And what they need to do is start researching online hedge funds and capital funds and family offices, and you look at those web pages and say, do they have a tech component? Do they have an operational business component? Do they like to put money into a startup? Because that's what they do. But those guys are not looking for 20-30% return.
Oh,
it's hundreds of percents returns. So,
and I think the lessons that you talked about, learning every day, networking every day, understanding even cycles, because the cycles in real estate, they tend to be more predictable, whereas a startup, like you said, it could be a very sharp cycle. And if Google releases something that
crushes
kind of, they have all this money and all of a sudden the startup just kind of drops off a cliff. And so there is risk for some of that. But there is the opportunity to make more risk, more reward, right? So you can make a lot more potential money, but in some cases,
or not. So I love how focused you are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, myself, I could just speak for myself and for every other entrepreneur out there, is we get shiny.
And I need to correct something. I have invested in some operational businesses.
How'd they go?
One of them is Four Rivers.
Oh.
So I'm an investor with Four Rivers. That's aspirational.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's doing okay.
Sure.
And I invested in the Coop there in Winter Park, and I can't eat there because it's too fattening.
So what about Four Rivers and the Coop? I mean, their food is amazing, and I'm a big fan of John Rivers, but what inspired you to say, you know what, I haven't invested in these kind of operating businesses before, but I'm going to invest in this operating business? What was that?
I have no idea why I did that. I don't even remember.
Did you have a long relationship with John Rivers?
I guess, and I don't remember how I met him. I know before he opened the Coop, he invited me over to cook for him one night, him and his family. And I cooked, you know, fried okra and cornbread, collard greens, all that kind of stuff.
Then he had an idea and said, I like what Mike did. I'm going to make some food for some other people.
He enjoyed his meal. So, but honestly, I don't remember how I got started and all that, so. But that's not very much, a couple hundred grand maybe invested.
But it could have made a big difference for him. And that kind of...
He doesn't need me.
Maybe not anymore, but back...
He never did. Trust me.
Yeah. Interesting.
So,
that's a guy you ought to interview, is John Rivers.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's got a really good story.
Definitely on our list.
We'll love an introduction through your network. So, In the entrepreneur world, one of the biggest challenges that I see, and this might be, I'd really like to capture wisdom, because you're like, nope, it's out of my lane. Nope, it's out of my lane. Well, I made this one exception, but I don't know why. But I stick in my lane, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do you stay focused? Because you chose real estate 19 mm-hmm. years ago to like dive in. How did you stay focused when there's so many shiny objects and shiny opportunities? How did you stay focused? Because that's one of my hardest challenges.
Well, so the first project I did where I bought that land using my $75,000, and what I said was that was a primer. You know what a primer is?
Yep.
It's a small book that teaches you something. And so it was a primer on how to develop apartments. So after I did that and spent 3 years and on $500,000 and whatever else I needed to do and learn from all my mistakes and survive the mistakes, and I was thinking, well, I don't want to go out and learn, spend 3 to 5 years, you know, learning a whole nother project. Let's just stick with multifamily for now. So I did another multifamily project on Dean Road at East West Expressway, which was close to my first project. We just sold the land, made really good money on that. But the economy was getting so heated that my numbers, so the formula you use, you go back to your formula, your math. If that math doesn't work and you haven't stressed your math, then that's what keeps you from making bad decisions. It's all about the math at the end of the day. And if those shiny objects don't meet the math test, then move on. They're too expensive, they're dangerous, or both.
Mm-hmm. What questions should I have asked you, should Dave and I have asked you that we didn't ask that you think is really important for entrepreneurs to think of?
I don't know. I'll probably think of a lot of stuff after you leave. I don't know. But, you know, it's just never give up. I mean, you got to have confidence and you got to have education and you got to get up every day and learn, even if you're learning of what is in your lane. So I'm learning every day about what I do, mm-hmm. which is office and multifamily. And land, I do a lot of land projects. And that's how we got started, okay? I bought the land, got it entitled, you know, increased the value significantly by changing the entitlements from office to multifamily. So, but you just gotta, don't give up, you know, work hard and think hard, get up early, work all day, think all day, think hard. That's what it's all about. And you got to also believe in the system. So I remember in 2008 and 2009, I remember getting out on the road. You know, there was not even hardly people driving. I mean, it was like dead. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just like you got in so many people were liquidating so much stuff, you would think nobody believes in capitalism anymore, right? And that's when you want to take your biggest plunges, is buy when people are liquidating, sell when everybody's buying. So that's what we do. So if you have a lot of buyers, that's when we're going to be selling. If you have a lot of sellers, that's when we're going to be buying. Because those buy and sell decisions on a national level kind of create price differentials that are very favorable to the person who has confidence in our system. So, okay, poop's hitting the fan. Nobody has any confidence in this system anymore. Well, that's when you have the most amount of sellers. So,
and the biggest discounts.
So when things are good, as they are right now, and I don't know how long they'll stay good, but I think we'll do pretty well for a while. So we need to be a seller, but we don't have anything to sell. So we have to build it and sell it. So we're building apartments and we're selling them. Because they trade at, 5.25% cap rate on the NOI. Whereas, there's a spread there. So if we're building these on a 7% return on cost, but we're selling them on a 5% return on cost, you're making a 200 basis point spread on the value. So you take that 200 basis points and divide it by the cost basis and your NOI, and that's kind of your profit. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I could draw it out on a board. But but at the end of the day, it's all about the math. You can't lose sight of the math. You just can't. I mean, it's because there's no such thing as 1 + 1 = 3. It's just in my lifetime, it's never been.
It's never worked, huh?
No.
Got it.
And you can't force the math. If you're forcing it, that means there's something wrong with your deal.
And that's where you're believing in your own bullshit if you're forcing the math.
If you're forcing the math or, you know, whatever. So I had a deal. We worked on it. We spent $300,000. We had a meeting at this table right here. Landowners wanted us to develop the deal. We raised all the capital we needed. We had everything ready to go. We got everything bid out, and when we got the last thing bid out, there was a muck problem. We were going to have to put some piles in. We had to put down like, I don't know, a couple of hundred piles to hold up the buildings because of some soil conditions, and it made their land worth less than zero. So we came in here in this meeting, and I said, you know, I got some bad news for you, is even if you gave me your land for free, I still wouldn't do the deal because I'd have to put another $2 million into it and you get nothing. And they were shocked, you know, but that was the math. That's what the math said. Well, the response to that was, we don't believe you because everybody, whoever everybody is, who's everybody? I don't know who that is. They said, everybody said our land's worth $2.5 million. I'm like, well, go sell it to everybody. I'm not your buyer. Because it's the math. Yep. You have to stick on the math. You have to have good budgets.
There's a lot of entrepreneurs that might have an operating business, but then they say, I want to make this income and take it to real estate. But, and you know, I've done some investments on a small scale with duplexes that have done pretty well. And they say, I want to do what you've done. And I think a lot of people listening to the show would say, I want to do what you've done. I would love to have apartment investments and have all this cash flow coming in. But I think that the emotion that they have in wanting to do a deal and not relying on the math, like you're saying, and the fundamentals, can cause them to do a bad deal and really get burned.
Correct. And then if you get a bad enough deal on these times, then you may be done for the rest of your life, potentially. Because it you know, a lot of people take a failure and they don't learn anything from it. I've had a lot of mistakes. We've had a lot of failures. We never lost money. We've always delivered a return, but we've made mistakes. I mean, don't think we haven't made mistakes. We made a lot of mistakes. But you always learn from those. And if you're underwriting correctly and you're keeping your expectations low and you're keeping your capital partners' expectations low, then you should be okay.
How are you finding right now in the real estate scene? Are you guys still looking? I know you have deals going on right now. You have some that you're developing and then looking to sell. In terms of finding good deals to invest in right at this moment in our market cycle, how bountiful are the good deal opportunities at the moment, would you say?
I think they're kind of tough. You know, we've probably underwritten in the last 12 months probably 6 to 10 apartment projects, and we rejected all of them because we just didn't feel confident in the math. You know, the math didn't look the way we would customarily like to see it. So we're a pretty small company. I mean, we've done a lot of deals, probably $500-800 million worth, but we're a small company of probably 4 or 5 people. And we can't afford to make a mistake. We can't afford to have a mediocre result. We just, you know, we don't feel like we're, you know, big company, national multifamily developer. They have a hiccup on one of 25 properties, then, you know, they'll probably cover it and it's not a big deal. You know, shit happens, you know. Yeah. But we're just not in that arena where we or would be willing to, you know, bet the farm on a particular project. So
one last question.
Sure.
What does an average day look like for you? Because you said every day you're learning, you're waking up early, you're hustling, you're growing in your craft.
Yeah.
Like, so what does an average day, kind of like give us a high level overview of what your average day looks like?
Get up and seem like I'm doing emails all day or reading legal documents. Even though I don't practice law anymore, everything we do has a legal ramification to it. There's deeds, mortgages, notes, term sheets from lenders, investors, so I get up and, you know, have breakfast and watch the news. I don't watch a lot of business channels. I hardly ever do that. Occasionally I do. I watch Bloomberg or Fox Business, and then CNBC, I think, has a good one, Squawk Box and some of those. I used to watch a lot of it, but I don't watch it anymore. And I don't really watch a lot of news in general. I've watched enough to keep current on what kind of chaos is happening in the world. But probably I watch a lot of YouTube, even in the morning, during the day, at night. I watch a lot of YouTube because I can find content that teaches me something. Somebody's been down that road. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's kind of like Cortez invading Mexico. He you know, wrote this book about how he did it. And then this guy from named Pizarro did the same thing down in South America with the Incas, or whichever ones
were following his playbook.
Yeah, they followed his playbook. You know, yeah. YouTube's a playbook. So, and I learn a lot on YouTube. So, and browsing the internet, searching for hedge funds and family offices that maybe want to do what we want to do. I don't know if any of that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, it seems like it's working pretty well.
I guess. Doing $700 million in deals.
Yeah, so for those out there, you know, like duplicate success, you know, like maybe watching YouTube videos, all, you know, like in networking, and maybe that's the way to go for you guys. But yeah. What is one last piece of wisdom you have for the audience before we say goodbye? I know I almost
no idea.
Promised one more question, but...
that's okay. What's one... I honestly don't know. I don't know.
The last piece of wisdom would be re-listen to this interview, because there's so much wisdom in there. You're going to find some good nuggets.
Yeah.
Yeah, the last one would be listen to this podcast over and over and over.
Yeah, there you go.
Not just me, but I'm sure you have a lot of entrepreneurs that have probably been very interesting and have a lot of nuggets of information. So I would say keep learning, keep listening, keep watching, keep asking questions. Don't ever give up, no matter what. So somebody said there will always be a barrier to what you want to accomplish. There always will be. You may not recognize the barrier, but the barriers are there. But once you recognize it and define it, why am I not moving forward? You've got to figure out how to go under it, go over it, go around it, or destroy it. You have to conquer it. Because if you don't conquer it, it's conquered you. And it's conquered you already. You just don't know it. Because if you stopped, you're done. If you're not moving forward to solution to go end goal, then you're done.
That's deep.
That's deep. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here on Orlando Entrepreneur Show. Thank you for listening in, Mike. Thank you for welcoming us into your home, sitting at this really cool table that's over 100 years old, and just being a part of your story.
You.
Ladies and gentlemen listening in, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Mike Wright of MMI Development. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I hope you learned something from this. If you have questions or comments about this interview or about the show, and you'd like to learn something from Mike or myself or David, just put it in the comments below, and we'll do a good job at responding to all of them.
And our webpage is MMI.com. It's very simple.
Great domain name, three-letter domain right there, MMI.com. All right, guys, I hope you have a lovely day. We'll talk to you all on the next episode.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.